Welcome to We've Got Issues. I'm Joshua Holland. This week, we're going to speak with Jared Yates Sexton. He's an associate professor of creative writing at Georgia Southern University. He also hosts the Muckrake podcast. We're going to talk to him about an apparently goofy new narrative making its emergence on the right, about the crisis, so-called crisis of masculinity. And Tucker Carlson had a weird special this week decrying this supposed collapse in American men's testosterone levels. It's entirely fictional. It's nonsense, but there's a point. And we've all been laughing about it, but Jared Yates Sexton says we shouldn't be. Then we're going to be joined by Shauna Sigelko. She's the director of digital storytelling for a group called Define America. It's an immigration advocacy and research group. And she's going to talk about the kind of network of anti-immigrant content that is on YouTube and how influential it is. We've got a lot to go over in the show, so I'm going to kind of skip the usual introduction, but I did want to do one little piece of housekeeping. Last week, we mentioned the political theater that Texas Governor Greg Abbott did at the southern border. He had, if you'll recall, he had previously sent all these National Guards troops to the border where they festered. They had nothing to do. It's a heavily militarized border. And then he set up these inspection points, state inspections for vehicles coming in from the border. Of course, there's a massive amount of interstate, international trade coming through the southern border. This caused all sorts of supply chain damage. And the point was to increase inflation, increase the supply chain disruptions that we've had as a result of the pandemic in order to hurt Joe Biden's approval rating, et cetera, et cetera. It's a political stunt. And it's a political stunt that just damaged all of us. Right. So for the sake of his, and this is a theme that just makes me crazy. They do these things for partisan purposes, and they don't care that it actually hurts their own partisans. Right. So there were, he eventually had to back off of this because there was like food rotting on trucks as they were stuck in these traffic jams and whatnot. And, I just wanted to point out that there was an effort to quantify the cost of this. So the Fresh Produce Association of the Americas, which is an industry group, it estimated that vegetable producers alone were suffering a loss of more than $240 million thanks to this stupid stunt. And that Americans can expect to spend that money, spend a quarter of a billion more on, you know, whatever produce is coming over the border. Again, this is not a local issue. It's going to hurt you wherever you live. And it was all in the service of this political theater. It's really crazy stuff. Anyway, we're going to, without further ado, we're going to take a quick break. And then come right back and talk to Jared Yates Sexton about the latest goofy panic on the right. Stay tuned.
Because my loneliness is
Welcome back. This week's unofficial theme, as it is many weeks, is right-wing propaganda and its growing reach and its kookiness sometimes. If you're like me, you probably had a little laugh at Tucker Carlson's new kick about America's so-called crisis of masculinity. Let's take a quick listen to the top-rated cable news host in the United States speaking to a recent guest, a very normal recent guest, about one way that we can combat the supposed scourge of low testosterone. You may have seen this clip before. It's kind of viral. Let's take a little listen.
You saw in the clip there, if you want to optimize and take it to another level, expose yourself to red light therapy.
Yes.
And the Juve that we were using in the documentary, there's a massive amount
Which is testicle tanning.
It's testicle tanning, but it's also full body red light therapy. Uh-huh. Which has massive amount of benefits. And there's so much data out there that isn't being picked up on or covered.
So obviously half the viewers right now are like, what? That's testicle tanning? That's crazy. But my view is, okay, testosterone levels like crash and nobody says anything about it. That's crazy. So why is it crazy to seek solutions?
It's not crazy to seek solutions. And I think I was recently exposed to a term called bromeopathy. And I think there's a lot of people out there right now that don't trust the mainstream information.
So we all had a kind of laugh, all of us sophisticated liberals. But our next guest warns that we should be thinking about this. We should be taking this not quite so lightly. Jared Yates Sexton is an associate professor of creative writing at Georgia Southern University. He also hosts the Muckrake podcast. And he also has a Substack, which you can Google. And at the top of that page, as we record today, is a piece titled The Fascist Cult of Masculinity. Jared, welcome back to the show.
How's it going, Joshua?
It's going okay, although I was exposed to this rather disturbing idea of sunbathing your balls. Your reaction?
Well, listen, this is just a normal practice around these places. You know, I'm actually more shocked that people aren't just, you know, used to this at this point. You know what I was thinking about as you were doing that intro? Have you noticed how many of these right-wing outlets and personalities are just constantly selling things for low testosterone? It's almost like this is about male insecurity. I don't know.
I mean, these are the, there is this very consistent theme throughout all conservative discourse that it's half alarmism about the impending collapse of society and half selling you prepper stuff. And this is kind of, and gold and the like. And this is, I guess, in part and parcel of that whole thing. So, I mean, we all had a big laugh of this, all of us sophisticated liberals, at this, this hogwash, this another entirely fabricated problem. Testicle tanning is hilarious, and the word bromeopathy is, I mean, that's worth $1 million right there. And Tucker's special titled The End of Men was intentionally goofy and prone to ridicule. He had these images of, the promo had these images of naked men, I don't know how to put this, like charging their junk in front of some kind of like charging station as this sweeping music plays. I appreciate that you began your piece noting that this promo was intentionally designed to go viral. And how often do you think we are seeing that? And do you think there's a growing recognition of the way that they're trying to get us to, in our outrage and our befuddlement, share and amplify their content?
You know what's weird about this is it actually has its roots with the New York Times. And anybody who's listening to this has obviously had an experience of waking up in the morning, grabbing your cup of coffee, and looking at a New York Times article on your feed and being like, what? What are we doing here? Why are you running this article? Why are we having this like weird illiberal thing that's in the New York Times? But the New York Times obviously knows that anything that they run, if it gets clicks, even if it's outraging people, that obviously leads to profit. And the right wing has absorbed this lesson. And they, you know, I think Donald Trump specifically was able to very much weaponize it. And so what we see at this point is anybody from Tucker Carlson to Marjorie Taylor Greene, Madison Cawthorn, you name it, this complete weird gaggle of trolls, they've learned that they're able to sort of gain power and game the system anytime they're able to, like, either upset people or, you know, invite ridicule. And when this stuff happens, it actually games the system, particularly on social media, and amplifies whatever it is that they're saying. So this thing that we're watching right now was absolutely designed to go viral. It was designed to be ridiculed. But I have to tell you, there's a lot of people out there who are watching this stuff, consuming this stuff, and it's not funny to them.
Yeah, that's right. And let's include people like Glenn Greenwald. This has become a model of disseminating content over social media. The rage clicks, man. That's a way to really get your stuff out there. We should all understand this tactic and maybe be more discerning about what we engage with and what we dunk on and what we just let pass, although there's obviously a like a big collective action problem there. Anyway, you argue that this very goofy nonsense is in fact kind of a gateway drug to neo-fascism. You write, and I quote, "Rhetoric surrounding masculinity and its crisis is part of a larger ideology and movement." Can you unpack that for us?
Yeah, so I just want to go ahead and start on this. So years ago when I wrote this book on the quote-unquote masculinity crisis, and what I found in my research and going deep into it is something that I think we all know, which is hypermasculinity and overcompensation, for anybody who isn't participating in it and anybody who isn't dealing with flagging masculinity or personal concerns about it, is absolutely absurd. You know, watching people overcompensate for insecure masculinity is just, it's just a comedy of errors watching people do this. But the people who are within it, particularly men who are insecure about themselves, who are frightened, who are alone, calls like this bizarre worship and commodification of hypermasculinity and this, you know, this Tucker Carlson promo, it's got men wrestling, chopping wood and cooking and you know, just doing all these very, very cliche masculine sort of activities. For men who feel insecure about themselves, particularly right now in this time where our economy has changed, the role of men has changed, the role of men in society has changed, that really rings out to them. And one of the things when you start traipsing through history, you start to notice that authoritarianism, fascism, Nazism, you name it, all of these things start as a cult of masculinity. It starts by taking a group of people who feel alone, they feel powerless, they feel emasculated for any reason under the sun. And basically it tells them, hey, guess what? You're actually a warrior and you're actually very, very strong. And anybody who tells you that masculinity or being a man is bad is part of a larger conspiracy that's coming for you. And as a result, it takes a lot of people who, because of economic circumstances, material conditions, are not doing well, particularly you have in a country like the United States of America, where industry obviously left going along with globalism, you have a lot of men who aren't able to make those livings the way that they used to, or they're not able to follow up on maybe what their fathers or grandfathers were able to do. You have a lot of people who are holding on to those old traditions, who feel powerless, alone, and as if society has turned their back on them. And instead of changing, they now have people who are telling them, no, lean into that, overcompensate, like actually embrace hypermasculinity. And so what we're watching right now with Tucker Carlson and with this nascent national conservative movement, which is actually taking over the GOP, we're watching those appeals gain speed and power and heft. And it's tracking along the exact same lines that we've seen with past authoritarian movements.
What is the end point here in celebrating this rather narrow and kind of toxic definition of masculine strength? Is there an ultimate goal?
Do you want to get in the weeds on this one? Because I'm happy.
I got 10 minutes.
Okay. There's a couple of things that are happening here. One is, you know, this whole right-wing idea that there's a conspiracy, that there are groomers out there, that society's being taken over by women and people of color. All of that sort of speaks to a larger thing, which is reinstating and reinforcing the old masculine hierarchy, the idea that particularly white, wealthy, evangelical men should control the world. And so by sort of fomenting a backlash against this stuff, it's actually taking on liberal democracy, which authoritarians always gender as feminine, right? Because it's the idea that you have to play by the rules, you have to work with other people, you have to be tolerant of things that, you know, you don't like. So they gender that as feminine, which is one of the reasons why, you know, Trump's coming out and saying, you know, the United States has gotten weak. You have Republicans who are saying that all of this stuff is being done from the outside, particularly by quote unquote Jewish puppet masters. Eventually, this is about taking power, but there's another element to it as well, which is globalism is reaching this refraction point where all of a sudden, you know, the United States was all about consumerism. It was about buying the products that other countries were manufacturing as industry left the country. Well, now it's going to boomerang back. And you are going to see national conservatism really trouble as they talk about nationalism and isolationism. They're going to try and bring industry back to the United States. And in order to do so, they have to get rid of things like the minimum wage. They have to get rid of regulations. They have to get rid of even like age restrictions. And in order to do all of that, they have to sanctify work, which is what happened for generations. Basically, you had a bunch of men who said, you know what, I don't care about my feelings, I don't care about my relationships, I'm going to go in and sacrifice my body in the factory, and that's what I give both my family and my community and, you know, my country. They have to re-sanctify that. And when you see these authoritarian movements and fascist movements, it's always about re-sanctifying that work and that labor. And if people don't want to go along with it, they'll bust your skulls, they'll hurt you. But in this, it's almost like a new story or a new mythology or a new religion that they're trying to recraft in order to sort of actually literally drag the country backwards.
You know, that is all kind of the bird's eye view, the 10,000 foot level, but I think it's important to understand that on a more basic level, the authoritarian far right movement relies integrally on intimidation. Yep. And the threat of violence, and this justifies that kind of bullying approach to politics. So you talk about in your piece, and I also followed a Twitter thread about how these ideas of masculinity have roots in all sorts of authoritarian movements of the past. How do you think they affect men who are, you know, that we're undergoing these, that we have an undiagnosed mental health crisis in this country and in the world as a result of the pandemic? Men have, and I don't want to discount how it impacts women who are in relationships with men, this kind of broader toxic masculinity. But this message, it has a political purpose, but it seems to me it does harm to people who it is appealing to.
It absolutely does. I mean, one of the things about this mental health crisis that we're in is it's building off past mental health crises. And masculinity, as it is gendered and defined, and it's always something, it's hard to talk about. We're talking about traditional masculinity here, the types of things that we have pressures for in the United States of America. It's actually a cycle of abuse. And masculinity is taught through socialization. It's taught basically from one father after another abusing their sons until they're unable to understand their own feelings, until they go ahead and cycle that abuse out. And, you know, we had this strange moment where, as deindustrialization was taking over, where we could have addressed that, where we could have finally said, guess what? We now live in a new environment. We have to work with one another. We have to communicate with one another. But instead, people doubled down, particularly as political pressures were being applied to them. So basically what's happened at this point is, you know, you have somebody like a Donald Trump who comes on the scene and basically knocked out decades worth of any sort of progress there possibly could have been, and said to a bunch of men, you know what, people tell you that you need to change, that you need to heal or whatever. That's not about you. That's about them. They're doing this in bad faith. They're trying to take over the country. And so what's happening as that conspiracy theory and as that narrative is being handed to them, it leads to radicalization. And one of the things that I keep finding in conversations that I have with former members of neo-Nazi groups, white extremists, white militias, is that all of these people recruit based on masculine insecurity. It's their number one way of radicalizing people. They basically say, the problem is not with you. And basically what that does is it legitimizes that socialization, that abuse that these people have gone through, the trauma that they've gone through. And it takes it from being trauma and abuse and turns it into not just a lifestyle, but a life's calling. And so you have a lot of men who are constantly trying to overcompensate for their own insecurity because, you know, traditional masculinity is not a real way of living. It's unattainable. It's full of contradictions. Yeah. But in order to work out those contradictions, they go ahead and they take out their own frustrations on society, and they become violent. They become belligerent. And
they become proud boys.
They become proud boys. Yeah. And they perform a role until they're no longer performing a role.
Yeah. And you mentioned this as a kind of an aside, but I want to center it more. We're seeing this kind of weird outburst by Tucker Carlson and others during this particularly vile moral panic over the LGBTQ community being stoked by the right. They're calling people, as you mentioned, who believe in equal rights for queer people groomers. They're passing laws infringing on like teachers' right to speak freely about their own relationships, and they're banning books and all of that. You know, if you recognize a broader spectrum of gender identity than these traditional, you know, male and female roles, that's a threat to this project. You talk about how there's a cyclical nature relationship between like liberalism and authoritarianism. And you also talk about how as dudes growing up in our capitalist society, we've kind of been primed for this message for very long time, even if we're not conscious about it. Can you tell us a little bit about your thoughts on that?
Yeah, so I'll start with the latter question. You know, one of the things that we've seen, and undoubtedly the people listening to this have seen it, and maybe it's occurred to them, but maybe not in the context I'm about to lay it out. One of the things that we've particularly seen post 9/11 is we've seen this thing with men, and as industry has gone away and men aren't necessarily making their livings the way that they were in the past, they're not able to have these jobs the way that they did in terms of like going in and making things. All of a sudden, you see a lot of men who are overcompensating their masculine insecurities via purchases. And a large part of these purchases, and you know, it's almost like white dudes at this point in the United States are given a white dude pack. And the white dude pack has like paramilitary t-shirts. You buy the big truck that's designed to sort of look like an operator in special forces. And you carry around a certain amount of guns, and you play this sort of almost modern G.I. Joe character. And in a way, like all of this stuff is very hackable. It's very usable. It's an entry point. So you roll around town and basically you're telling yourself that you're like a big, strong man who's capable of retaking the country. And the next thing you know, you're told, guess what? The country needs retaken. So it's a very, very primed sort of an entry point. And in all of this, and going back to this, you know, quote unquote groomer thing, the cycle is this. As liberalism is all about the idea that free markets and property are what matter, and that'll take over, that'll make everything fine. Meanwhile, you have multiculturalism, you have liberal democracy in which people get to choose. Authoritarians always deliver the same message, which is liberal democracy is a weakness. It's literally the way in which we allow outsiders, again, quote unquote, Jewish puppet masters, and internal traitors to take over the country, because they'll just, I don't know, bring people in over the border, or they'll steal elections. And so what they eventually say is liberal democracy doesn't work for them is that culture has become degenerate. And all you need to do for this is go back into, you know, the early 20th century in a place like Germany, the Weimar Republic, where the Nazis looked around and they saw, you know, gender conformity, which was being tested. They saw different types of popular culture that they found detestable. They told everybody, this is a Jewish plot to destroy Germany and to undermine the country. And as a result, you're under attack. Right? They looked at gay people and they said, this is degeneracy. We have to roll this back. We have to create something else. we're watching the same thing happen now, because the base of national conservatism and this white evangelical authoritarian power grab is to say liberal democracy was a weakness. It allowed people on the outside and internal traitors to take us over. And now we are in a period of degeneracy. And like that stupid promo on the Tucker Carlson show, the idea is only strong men, only warriors ready to take the reins for themselves are going to be the ones who can restore order. And it's always about restoring order in this cycle.
And weakness is associated with femininity, and that's the connective tissue here. Jared, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me today. I really do appreciate it.
Thanks so much.
Folks, stay tuned. We're going to take a quick break, and then we'll be right back.
You seek of only vanity, and no love for humanity shall fade away, fade away. He who checks for only wealth and not for his physical health shall fade away, fade away. Though some believe in diamonds and pearl and feel like they're on top of the world, they shall fade away. Hear what I say. The rich is getting richer every day. And the little that the poor man got, it shall be taken away. Do you hear what I say? Yeah, hear what I say.
Welcome back. You know, it's been increasingly clear over the last, 10 years or so that there are now parallel information systems. We have the legacy media and also various alternative media that we see on our feeds. They still hold a lot of sway. And then there is this more diffuse information, or in many cases, disinformation system on social media that has been growing in impact. And we do a lot of media criticism on the program. That is, we look at the former, but it's harder to track the latter. You know, it's harder to keep track of what's bubbling on the fever swamps of the internet. And a lot of people don't trust our institutions, including our media institutions, for both good reasons in some cases and because bad actors have sown cynicism in them in other cases. And a lot of people are, as a result of that, getting their views shaped by Telegram and YouTube and Facebook. And you can look at, like, Facebook helped Donald Trump get elected. There's no question about that. WhatsApp was crucial in Jair Bolsonaro's election in Brazil. So, you know, it is important to try to keep track of this. So my next guest is going to help us understand a little bit about how this works in one toxic little corner of the information ecosphere. Shauna Sigelko is the Director of Digital Storytelling for Define American, which is a research and advocacy group focusing on immigration. And she's a co-author of a new report titled Immigration Will Destroy Us and Other Talking Points that looks at how the so-called Great Replacement Theory, which is incredibly consequential, and we'll talk about that in a minute, has been promoted on YouTube. Shauna, welcome to We've Got Issues.
Hi, Joshua. I'm happy to be here.
Thanks for taking the time to share your work with us. Let's start with the big picture. You and your colleagues identified what you call in the report the Great Replacement Network, specifically on YouTube. What is that?
Yes. So the Great Replacement Network is the name that we assigned for a network of YouTube channels that have produced the top performing anti-immigration content of the last 15 years. So just to go a little bit into the background, Define American, we are a narrative change organization. We were founded in 2011 by Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Jose Antonio Vargas, who also happens to be an undocumented American. So when he founded the organization, he really understood the power of story to shape our culture and the narrative. And our organization's goal is to do just that, to shift the narrative about immigration discourse in this country through media representation. And a couple years ago, we started noticing that disinformation and misinformation online were really driving that narrative around immigration. And we also realized that we, as an organization and more widely as an immigrant rights movement, didn't really have a grasp on what those narratives are. So we decided that we really wanted to understand the landscape of social media when it comes to immigration narrative. And we decided to start with YouTube because a few reasons. A lot of research was pointing in that direction. There is a fantastic study that came out of Data and Society called the Alternative Influencer Network by researcher Becca Lewis that looked at this, like you mentioned in the intro, looked at this alternative media ecosystem on the platform. And while it wasn't immigration focused, we knew that a lot of those talking points and subject matters covered by this kind of dark corner of YouTube were attacking immigrant communities. So our goal was to create a landscape analysis of what those anti-immigration content creators look like, who are the top performing creators, what are their videos, and what content are they pushing? So like I mentioned, we created a landscape analysis of the last 15 years. We identified the top performing anti-immigration videos. And we really were able to identify two central patterns in the content. So one side, we identified a narrative pattern, and the other side, which I'm a filmmaker in my background, so this side was fascinating to me. We were able to identify an aesthetic packaging consistency in the content. But going back to the first pattern, on the narrative side, we identified that almost all of the videos in our network and these videos, like I mentioned, top performing of the last 15 years, over 100 million views, really viral stuff. Our network includes huge brands like Fox News or the New York Post. We were able to identify that kind of the foundational connective tissue between these videos on a narrative perspective was the great replacement theory.
What is aesthetic packaging? What do you mean by that?
Yeah, glad you asked. So when I say aesthetic packaging, I'm talking about sort of formal production elements. So we looked at the different genres of the videos. We looked at their animation styles. We even did a test to look at the different types of messengers. And the pattern that we noticed pretty early on in the majority of the videos is that they are presented as sort of educational content, either in the form of an explainer video or, a straight to camera discussion that feels almost like in an academic setting. One of the videos that is the most viral, and I think one of the most important anti-immigration videos ever created. It's called Immigration, World Poverty, and Gumballs. It's produced by an anti-immigration group called Numbers USA. It has over 6.5 million views on YouTube, over 130 million views on Facebook. Really, really viral piece of content. It features this guy named Roy Beck, who's the president of the Numbers USA group, presenting a lecture that almost feels like it's a college course. And he does this extensive data visualization with gumballs. It feels very academic, almost dry. And the truth is he's not an academic. He's not a professor. I don't know where that video was shot. The common consistency we saw through the many of the videos is that they're presenting their biases and their messages as if they're coming from a place that's strictly logical, based in data and academic.
And just so folks understand that this has roots, this networking has roots that go back pre-internet age, oh, yeah. Right? So Numbers USA is a project of this guy named John Tanton. He's called the kind of godfather of the anti-immigrant network, the anti-immigrant movement, sorry. And he's been responsible in creating this like alphabet soup of organizations, the Center for Immigration Studies, Federation for American Immigration Reform, blah, 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 blah. And these all are think tanks and they influence legislation. They often get their quote unquote experts and their research quoted in mainstream legacy media publications. So they have an enormous amount of influence on the offline discourse. And here we see that creeping into, not creeping into, being kind of injected into the online discourse in a way that's really, well, that's really destructive. Let me ask you this. Can we assess how much impact these videos have? Like, you and your colleagues tried to quantify how much sway they had on people who watched them, right?
Yeah. So it's a difficult question to truly understand how much a piece of content is impacting the millions of people who watch it. So our method was to run tests on the back end. So we partnered with a research organization called Swayable, and we did a number of tests around genre, animation style, messenger, to see really what is the best packaging style to reach people who are unsure about the issue of immigration and what's most likely to sway their opinion. And what we found in our research is actually the style that's the most prominent in our network, in the Great Replacement network, is the same as the style that tests the highest amongst the movable middle audience. So we can deduct that, you know, it's not just that they have millions and millions of views. We also see that the style of the content is very effective in changing hearts and minds on this issue. We didn't do as deep a dive into the pro-immigration content on YouTube, but we did look at, you know, the top performing pro-immigration videos of the last 15 years as well, and we didn't see explainer videos in their ranks. So what we're hoping this report can really shed light on is that there's a big opportunity for the immigrant, the pro-immigration side, to look at what style of packaging and what types of genres and messengers are most accessible to portions of the population who are not yet on our side, and figure out if there are ways that we can package our messages and speak in a more accessible way to those audiences.
And you also, back in 2020, conducted polls of voters in swing states who were regular watchers of YouTube. According to the report, you found that 63% of them talked with friends or family about immigration after watching something on YouTube. A large share contacted a political representative or changed their views on immigration because of content that they saw on YouTube. This is impactful stuff. We've heard a lot from critics of YouTube about how their algorithms push people toward extremist accounts. Do you know if this is one of those situations where you start looking at cute cat videos and then a few YouTube recommendations later, you're watching some dude claiming that there's a genocide against white people underway?
Yeah. Well, I cannot claim to understand how the algorithm works.
Nobody
outside
can.
Of...
They're
yeah,
opaque,
exactly.
Right? That's a problem.
Yeah. Outside of, you know, what we know from reporting about how they've designed the algorithm. I will say to the polling that you were speaking about, we were actually pretty surprised at how high the numbers were around the translation of viewership of immigration content on YouTube into actual action. The 63% number that you mentioned, 63% talked with friends or family about immigration after watching something on YouTube.
That's stunning.
It's stunning, right?
It really is, yeah.
What was really surprising to us, we Define American also works in entertainment media. We advise showrunners and writers in Hollywood around depictions of immigrants. And the Norman Lear Center came out with a study in 2018 that asked a similar question around mobilization based on viewership of something on traditional television. And that number was lower. I believe it was 59%. So what we're seeing in these numbers is that YouTube has an incredible capacity for pushing audiences that are viewing the content into real world action. And I think the important piece here is which direction are they going to go? There's also fantastic research that came out of Harvard, a book called Network Propaganda by Yochai Benkler, Robert Ferris, and Hal Roberts back in 2018. I don't know if you're familiar with this book. It's fantastic. But they were able to basically trace how Breitbart and Steve Bannon online really forced the issue of immigration into the center of the 2016 presidential debates. And we all know how that turned out. So I really think, you know, it's not just our study. There's a lot of research out there that points to immigration narratives online being an incredibly important space for our politics and obviously for mis and disinformation in our society.
Yeah. Speaking of disinformation, you talk about how a key strategy for these accounts is to portray the kind of xenophobic anti-immigrant position as coldly rational and right. the pro-immigration position as like emotional or illogical. Can you tell us a little bit about that theme that you kind of identified?
Sure. And I think it's important to remember when we're talking about these really important debates around mis and disinformation, that a lot of what we're talking about isn't strictly disinformation or misinformation. It's around narrative and it's around framing. The great replacement theory, there are a lot of pieces that you can disprove with fact checking, but at the end of the day, if it's subtly baked into Fox News coverage or a viral video on YouTube, it's much harder to combat. It's much harder to deplatform a narrative than it is to combat mis and disinformation. And I think that that's what we saw really prevalently in our network. We saw what our researcher, Dr. Francesca Tripodi of UNC, who deserves a huge shout out because she developed the methodology for this landscape.
Also, she waded through a bunch of like toxic garbage.
YouTube. So many hours.
Need like of hazard pay for that.
Totally. We were checking in on her mental health a lot.
Oh, you have to.
What she identified though is that there's a lot of mis and disinformation in there, but there's also a lot of malinformation, which the inaccuracy lies in the framing. So you'd see a lot of videos where they would take a statistic wildly out of context and present it as a foregone conclusion because there is a statistic attached to it. It feels rooted in logic and, it feels like a sturdy fact that you can trust. And trust was something we looked a lot at in this report because, as you've mentioned, you know, trust in traditional news media is at an all-time low. People are turning to YouTube and platforms, other social platforms for their information and for their education around what's happening in the world around them. And it seems the other side really has understood how to package the information around the issue of immigration so that it feels reliable and trustworthy.
And I guess we're coming late to that party. We're learning late, but we are kind of at your, thanks to people like you and your colleagues, are kind of figuring out some of this for, to deploy on the side of good. And there was some good news here in your research. You found some encouraging results when pro-immigrant advocates push back on these narratives using some similar communication techniques. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, sure. And thank God we found something hopeful in this report, truly.
Well, it's difficult.
Yeah.
It's a regular theme on the show. It's such a depressing time to cover politics. And we always try to like pull out that little hopeful thing.
And it's so needed. The news is very bleak. But we did find a little nugget of hope here. So we did a test where we ran the very prolific far-right channel PragerU. Their bread and butter is explainer videos. They've really expanded. I'm sure a lot of your viewers know what PragerU is, but just in case, they are a very, very popular far-right channel on YouTube. Their budget this year, I think, was $20 million. They have over 4 billion views. One in three Americans has seen one of their videos. They're making classroom curriculums right now. So really powerful far-right channel. We found them all over our network. Their anti-immigration videos do very well. We took one of their videos, and then we produced our own video that had the same aesthetic. Same background color, same animation style. We even tried to match as closely as possible the identity of the host. So their video featured a younger Asian woman. Our host was also a younger Asian woman to account for bias. And we tested the two videos back to back, also the same subject matter, except ours was pro-immigration and theirs was anti. And our video performed significantly better. And this is the audience that we tested this with is part of that movable middle I was talking about earlier. People who are neither super pro nor super anti-immigration, they're still making up their minds. And I am hesitant to say this one test is the kind of the magic bullet. I'm
sure.
Not to backtrack on our desire to have some hope here. It is hopeful. I don't think it's the end all be all, but what it really points to is that there are opportunities to reach this audience if we meet them where they are and we produce content that feels accessible and familiar to them. One of our recommendations in our toolkit that we produced in collaboration with the report is that we need to, the pro-immigration space needs to pay more attention to the types of content that our target audience are consuming. So if they're watching Duck Dynasty, which we know they are, why does our content not use the same visual cues? Why does it look completely different? We need to be speaking more the cultural language of the populations we're trying to reach.
And, it's important for people to also understand the kind of broader context here. This is about this kind of, it is a neo-fascist narrative, the Great Replacement Theory.
Yep.
It tells you that you're going to be, squeezed out by parasitic forces from below. You're caught between elites above and parasitic forces below. It's a classic right populism. Studies show that the belief that people of color are becoming a majority in America, which, by the way, is a widely embraced myth. I mean, you see this in the mainstream discourse as well. We should do a whole show kind of unpacking the problems with that narrative. That belief makes white people more conservative. It makes them less likely to support public benefits. A recent study showed that it makes them less likely to that it predicted support for Donald Trump better than many other factors. If listeners want to check out this report that Shauna and her colleagues have done for themselves, they can find it online at defineamerican.com. There is, as Shauna mentioned, a toolkit to check out. Shauna, I believe we are out of time this week, but I really want to thank you for joining us and sharing your work.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'd also like to thank Jared Yates Sexton and David Edwards, our producer and engineer. I'd like to thank the good folks at Alternet and Raw Story for supporting the show. You can follow me on Twitter at Joshua Hall, H-O-L. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. Of course, I would like to thank all of you good people for tuning in. Have a terrific week, and don't roast your balls in the sun. That's not good for you. Pools of sorrow.